Interesting. He was called alligator bait, and also the fans would yell at him, go back to the cotton fields. And he and I talked about, and we'll get into this a little bit later on, about what he had to endure when he was breaking Babe Ruth's record and all the hate mail that he got. But was he steeled against that type of racism because of what he saw in Mobile, Alabama? I always felt that he was able to build the wall so that he could hide behind it when he chose to.
Sure, absolutely. I think you're 100% right about that. But I also think that it was also his personality that served him very well. I think in many ways his personality didn't serve him, but in this case it certainly did, because Henry Aaron was able to do something that very few people are able to do, and that is compartmentalize work, home, and everything else around you. That when he focused on the batter's box, he was able to do that in a way that not many players could do today or before.
And that's where he copied Jackie Robinson, because Jackie was a little bit more fiery, but he was the type of guy that when people did the type of nasty things that they did to African-American players at that time, he turned around it and used it as motivation and energy and passion for playing the game and made them pay for it on the playing field.
Sure, but Robinson was way more prone to explosion than
right.
Henry. And I think that if Henry had Robinson's personality, it would have been much, much more difficult, because I think Henry Aaron played in more difficult situations. The Dodgers made sure that Robinson played his minor league games pretty much away from the South. Henry was right in the middle of it.
Henry Aaron's batting ability, his hitting ability, it's kind of interesting because he is not a big man. And I looked at him, and as I used to watch him on film and I talked to other people, players that played with him, I said, what was the, you know, Dusty Baker and I are friends, and I said, what was the source of his power? And they said his wrists. But I was interested to learn from your book that because of an injury when he was young, he shifted his weight to his left foot, his
mm-hmm.
front foot, when he hit, which is totally the opposite than what you normally do.
What you're supposed to do. And that was the reason why Ted Williams would look at him and say, this guy does everything right except that. It's not possible to generate that much power coming off your front foot. It's supposed to come from your back leg, your waist, and then weight distribution through the zone. But Henry would stomp forward and shift his weight and drive his power way before the ball got there, and he was still able to do what he did.
When you look at what he was able to do, was it in the wrists? Was that primarily where his power came from?
Absolutely. But he was also a wiry guy. I think when the photos of Willie Mays as a young guy, Willie Mays looked like he had absolutely no body fat whatsoever. Henry looked much thinner, and Henry was bigger than Willie. Henry was 6 foot, and Willie was 5'10". But Aaron was much more wiry. Aaron was more quick, whereas Mays was pretty well built. And it's always fascinating with Henry because there's so much of his power that seems to be kinetic. It's a physics thing, where he goes through the zone, and you just look. I remember asking players when I was doing the research, who was the player that maybe reminded you most of Aaron? And people would always say Alfonso Soriano, where Soriano in his earlier days would just seem to just flip his bat out in the middle of the zone and generate tremendous power.
When you take a look at the early part of his career, he comes up with the Milwaukee Braves in 1954. He leads the team along with Warren Spahn to the World Series twice. He won one before he was the age of 25. Did he think this game was rather easy with that type of early success?
Well, I think that he felt that there was going to be numerous opportunities to win numerous championships, and there weren't. And I think that's one of the very interesting things about the Henry Aaron narrative, which has always rested on this suggestion that he's this understated, forgotten player. That's not true. When Henry Aaron came up, he was a phenom. When the Milwaukee Braves were at the center of the baseball universe, Henry Aaron was right there with them. The secondary narrative that he became forgotten came only when the Braves and then later Atlanta were no longer in the pennant race. And what happened to Aaron was that 10-year gap between 59 and 68 when they weren't in contention, well, 60 to 68 when they weren't in contention, that changed the Hank Aaron narrative completely, because that was when he put up That's when he made his Hall of Fame charge, and nobody was watching because the Braves were an 85-win team.
A lot of people thought he was lazy, did they not, because of his casual style?
Well, I think, and that's one of the things you talk about, the defense mechanisms. You have to remember how he was depicted in the press. And he put up his walls because people would treat him the way they treated him. They didn't. The fans didn't just call him alligator bait. His own manager referred to him as step and fetch it. And you had this minstrel character, and that's what I meant about the American timeline, how Henry Aaron serves as it. People talk about him today as this regal figure, this man of dignity, and yet if you go back to his early days, the press treated him as anything but that. They treated him as a clown, as a sideshow, who was this kind of lackadaisical, stereotypical black field hand. And he was aware of that. He knew what was going on, and he put up those walls. And then in the 1960s, you see things change as the country changes. And suddenly, instead of this aloof black figure, Henry Aaron is suddenly a civil rights guy. And now people are saying, where did this come from? Because they had treated him so poorly earlier. And you can see that as the country changed, so did the depictions of him. And I'm sure there's a part of him that was thinking, well, it's not me that changed, it's you. Why didn't you understand who I was sooner?
But when you take Howard a look at him, did he ever get, did everything ever, you know, pull back that type of pressure? When did he finally get the respect that he deserved?
Well, I think he always had respect in certain quarters. Obviously, I think that one of the big moments for him was the 69 playoffs against the Mets when the Braves, the first year of the championship series. It seems that Henry Aaron had been in the playoffs three times in his career, and each time had to deal with the New York team, 57, 58, and 69. And I think he was so brilliant in that playoff that people began to rediscover him. And on top of that, when you started doing the math, you realized that Mays wasn't going to be the guy to get to Ruth. So that combination made people look at Henry Aaron again. Jim Murray of the Los Angeles Times never had to rediscover Henry. He had written about Aaron as the great Henry Aaron since the 1950s. And then I think the other thing, unfortunately, for Mr. Aaron was steroids. I think the steroid era, as Barry Bonds elevated, Henry Aaron elevated even higher because the public began looking for people that it respected beyond the actual numbers. And I know that Henry was uncomfortable about this because I'm sure, you know, because he was thinking, well, you know, you don't need me to talk about this, but you don't get to choose your moment either. I remember asking him where he fit today. I remember him being very disappointed that he was thrust in the middle of the steroid era when he says, it's really not my issue. And I remember asking him, do you feel happy that now people are looking to you, that you're finally getting the respect that you've deserved for so long? And I know that he was saying to me, well, no, not really. And I remember thinking, well, you don't get to choose your moment. You don't get to choose what the issue is going to be that is going to make people look to you as a leader. All you can do is decide whether or not you're going to accept the mission. And steroids, the steroid era, really did return Henry to a place of respect where you start to look, and it goes back to the thing that we were talking about earlier, about these values, about this value system, that something has gone wrong in this country and we've begun to look to people who remind us of what we believe that ideal is supposed to be. I know that Henry is probably thinking in a lot of different ways, well, that's all well and good, but where were you when it was my turn? Because when he thinks about his moment, April 8th, 1974, he was not considered this regal figure. There were a lot of people who didn't want him to succeed. And so he's got these two visions of America that have always been conflicting.
Let's talk about the pursuit of Babe Ruth's record for just a moment. And again, I go back to the interview that I had with him from his book about breaking the record. When did he think that he actually had a chance to set that mark?
Started about 67. 67, 68, he started to do the math. He was still a relatively young man, and he realized that if he was going to play six more years, all he had to do was simply do what he kept doing, what he was already doing. When he started to do the math about Mays, Mays was going to have to increase his home run totals as he got older. And it became pretty clear that he wasn't going to be able to get there. Frank Robinson, the rest of them, they didn't have the numbers. But Henry Aaron, all he had to do was continue to average about 32, 33 home runs, which is exactly what he was doing anyway. And that's how he knew he had a shot at the record. And I think that when that became clear, I think his focus completely sharpened because he realized that it was in his grasp. And I think that was kind of the beginning of him reaching the conviction that this is going to be something that I can call my own.
What I found interesting was that I know he was playing on a very hapless Braves ball club, that he was able to hit the home runs that he did, because we know what happened with Barry Bonds when he started going after that mark, after Hank Aaron's mark. They started pitching around him. They would walk him and everything. I was surprised that he was able to do it, especially with that team.
Well, I think it's a different time. I mean, that's the thing, is that today, the baseball that we watch, and nobody would pitch around it. Players the way they pitched around Bonds. I mean, Bonds became bigger than the game. Bonds had turned into a video game to be intentionally walked 120 times in a single season. It was really something that the old schoolers were thinking that this isn't the baseball they remember. At some point, you still had to give the man his chance, and that's why, I mean, Henry Aaron still had pretty impressive intentional walk totals, but I think that was more generational than anything else.
When you think about the hate mail that he got, how did he kind of diffuse that type of pressure, along with the pressure that he was obviously getting from the media and maybe those fans that were certainly split over whether they wanted to have an African-American break that record?
I don't think he did. I don't think he diffused it at all. I think he carried it. It stayed with him. It stays with him. I think it lessens a little bit today because we're so far removed from it all. But while it was happening, he remembered all of it. He kept all of it. He knew what was happening. And he totally was aware that this is being taken away from him, this being this moment of joy. And I don't think that there was any mechanism that he could have employed or that he did employ to mitigate it. In fact, all of his intimates that spoke to me about this kept saying, you know, they all told me the same anecdote in many different ways about when nobody was around, you could see he was cracking. He was breaking. There was nothing that was assuaging the pressure that he felt. And I think Wayne Minshew, who was the beat writer for the Atlanta Constitution back then, said it best. He says, as soon as the record was broken, all he said was, I'm going home.
When he reflected back on what he had accomplished, what sense of accomplishment and appreciation did he have about what he had done?
Well, I think he's always been proud. And I think he is very much aware of his accomplishments. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was never particularly enthusiastic about this book, or why he was never particularly enthusiastic about trying to tell everybody what he did or clarifying his positions. Let the words, let the deeds speak for themselves. Let the stat sheet speak for itself. I know what I did. I don't have to go out and tell everybody what I did. And so I think that despite everything that he went through, despite the changes in the country, despite the fact that it wasn't a great time for him when he broke the record, even though today it's universally celebrated, I still think there's a piece of him that is very proud of his own accomplishments. I remember asking him, when no one's around, when you're by yourself and you're just you and your thoughts, is there any moment where you kind of sit back, you know, and you put an umbrella in your drink and you say, I made it? And he just kind of gave a little smile. And I think he does know that at some point. But I also know that he realizes that there's no point being self-satisfied. It's a very interesting balance for him. He wants to help other people. He wants the entire condition for African Americans to be better. But I think he's also very proud of what he's done.
Well, Howard, the one thing I came away with when I talked to him about breaking the record, and I put that question to him, I said, in your own private moments, quiet moments, when you're sitting down having a drink, what do you think about? And the one thing I came away with is that he was pretty much without ego, or if he had one, it was kind of subverted to a great degree because he knows what he did. He also understands that there's nothing that you can do about changing people's opinions or their thoughts or anything else. So why waste the energy? And I came away with a deep respect for that approach to his life.
Well, and that's true. And I think that that came out of simply frustration. He never got along with the press well enough to feel like it was an ally. And I think that he had always said to himself, well, what is the point of correcting the correction? Then I've got to correct that. So I just backed away. And I think that's a good example of the walls that he put up. He understood at once, whether it worked in his favor or whether it didn't, that he was never going to be viewed the right way.
Howard Bryant and The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. It's a story of one of baseball's great icons. Finally, Jerry Robinson was a three-time All-American at UCLA and is a member of the College Football Hall of Fame. He was drafted in the first round by the Philadelphia Eagles and rejoined his college coach, Dick Vermeil, there. He played for the Eagles for 6 years, played and lost to the Raiders in Super Bowl 15, and finished up his 13-year playing career with Oakland. Football can take its toll on your body, but when we sat down, I told him he looked like he could still play.
You want me to pay you now or pay you later for that one? I appreciate that. I really do, Ron. Thank you.
Does anything hurt on you? I mean, 13 years in the NFL and the battles that go on, and I think about the stories that we've heard about players after their careers are over with. What's your body like?
It'd be easier to tell you what doesn't hurt. Ed, you know, I've just had a total hip replacement a year and a half ago. My right hip, I got a titanium hip in there. My back hurt, my knees hurt, my knee and my neck. Everything hurts. You know, the amazing thing about football is that I didn't realize it, that I've always been in pain. My body was used to being in pain for 13 years. And during the course of the season, you know, you get shots, you get medication, and you just get used to not really feeling any pain. So after I retired, which was 18 years ago, all of a sudden there's no more shots, there's no more pain pills, there's no more whatever it is, no more treatment. You can't go to the facility and get treatment. Then my body started to wake up and said, yo, my brother, you are a total wreck.
Well, what's that battle like then after you all of a sudden have this treatment stopped and then you've got to battle mind and body?
You have to be strong. You have to really be honest with yourself. And for a long time, I didn't want to admit to the fact that maybe my body was really broken down more than I wanted to admit it. But I got to a point where with my hip, I'd go see my daughter Jill or go see Jackie, and I'd have a hard time in the airport. You know, when you get to one airport, you got to catch a connecting flight. And my connector always seemed to be 3,000 miles away. But the last time, a couple of years ago, I just couldn't take it. I wanted to flag down that guy in that little cart, you know, but my pride wouldn't allow me to do it. So I realized then that, you know what, it's time to do something about it. But I just had a hard time because when you're playing ball, it's a physical game to start with, and there's this mental toughness that you go through. You get conditioned all your life trying to be tough. You keep hearing from people, you got to be tough, don't show any emotion and this and that. And I think the hardest part of it was really being honest with myself and admitting that, you know what, there's some things that are wrong with you and you should get them taken care of.
The thing that amazes me about you and other athletes that have played physical sports like this, Jerry, is that no matter what they feel like, what they've gone through, what they know it's going to be like after their playing careers are over with, they all say it was worth it. And I don't understand that mentality, because if I get up in the morning and say I don't feel well, I can call in sick to work. Most people can do that. You can't do that in pro sport. So what is it about the mentality of playing football that allows you and the others to do that?
We're crazy. But the part about you, there really are no sick days. And I'm going to tell you a story. When I was playing for the Los Angeles Raiders, my second to the last year, there was this bug, this flu going around. I mean, it was just knocking people out. I was at home, woke up one morning, had to go to practice, and I was so sick. I was sweating from head to toe, I was nauseous. I was very, very, very sick. I mean, I was really, really ill. I got on the phone and I called down to the Raider complex to the trainer. And I said, George, I feel like I'm going to die. I said, I'm so sick. Things are coming out at every place, this and that. I really think I'm going to die. George said, Jerry, tell you what you do. Don't even put your shoes on. Get in your ride, come off the hill, come down to this facility, and die in here. I said, what? He said, Jerry, that's just the way they said. You don't have to do anything, but I'm telling you, there are no sick days in professional football, unless you're Bo, and Bo knows everything. So, you know, the only person the only person I've ever seen in my entire 13-year career that if he didn't feel like it, like going out to practice, he wouldn't go out to practice. That was Bo Jackson. Bo knows. Bo knew everything. I mean, one day we had this rain, this unbelievable rain in Southern California. You know, it never rains in Southern California. This day, it was a downpour. And it was so horrible it was lightning and thundering. I mean, unless you live in Florida, you're used to that kind of stuff, but not in Southern California. We're getting ready to go out to practice. Bo Jackson walks in with a cup of noodles, steam coming off the top. I said, Bo, what are you doing? He said, Bo don't know rain. I'm like, okay. Bo don't know rain. He said, yeah, Bo don't know rain. Bo don't do rain. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I talked to the man upstairs, speaking about Al, and I told him I didn't feel like getting wet. So he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm going to sit back and watch all my children, a couple soap operas, this and that. So what happened? We went out there to practice and came back. But Bo's the only person I know that's been able to pull that off.
How important was peer pressure? I mean, you know as well as I do that if the other guys are laying it out there, you're not going to be the one not to.
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting, that peer pressure. I've had several injuries before, but I've only broken one bone, which is my little finger on my left hand. That's it. I haven't had many major things like that happen. The worst thing that can happen to an athlete is sprain your ankle. You'd rather it be broken in a cast, because if it's not in a cast, you can't play. Not only are the people in the stands looking at you crazy, sometimes your teammates look at you a little weird, especially if they really don't know the severity of the injury, how long it's going to be. And that is very, very, very difficult to do. I've seen a lot of people come back early because of peer pressure. And actually, that happened to me too. But it's just, you just want to be out there with your teammates, and you don't want to feel like you're stealing, like you're backing up to the cage to get your check. You know, you want to put your honest day's work in. And it is, there's a lot of peer pressure. But like I said, if you ever sprain your ankle, you'd rather be in a cast and crutches so everybody can see I'm hurt. I'm not faking.
And the worst guy probably for setting the standard for ball players was Jack Youngblood because of the story of him playing with the broken leg.
When it was in the Super Bowl.
It was in the Super Bowl.
You know, I couldn't believe it. I said, wait a minute. Youngblood, he's playing, he's running around with a broken leg. Yeah, he made it kind of difficult on everybody else.
Let's go back to your high school days of playing football. When did you realize that you were a pretty good athlete?
I just remember growing up in Santa Rosa, California. I just wanted to play every sport that I could. I loved soccer more than anything else, actually. I wasn't even crazy about football for a long time, and I loved basketball, and I loved baseball. Baseball got boring to me in high school, that hey, batter, batter, swing stuff, but if I could do it all over again, I wished I hadn't have never thrown away that glove. I'd probably still be playing. I don't know. I just knew when I was in high school, I remember what I did as a freshman in high school. I remember I took a piece of paper, Ron, and I wrote down my goals. I would be a professional athlete, football, basketball, or baseball. I don't know which one is going to be. And I wrote down the goals and the things that I felt that I needed to do to achieve. I didn't know which sport it was. I just enjoyed playing. I'm one of those people that was brought up to, you know, you respect people, you know, be humble. It wasn't important to me to open up a newspaper to see what I might have accomplished. It was just more important for me to be the best teammate that I could be. You know, I figured I don't have time to sit there and read a newspaper. You got your head in the paper. Trust me, there's someone is going to pass you by.
You certainly had a linebacker's mentality, and I'm just wondering, when you were playing basketball or soccer or baseball, did that carry over?
Well, you know what it is? I have I to tell you, yeah, it did. It did carry over, but I've had people tell me that I couldn't do certain things in different sports, and I'll just take you back to the football part of this. When I went to UCLA as a wide receiver, and Coach Vermeil.
But you were recruited as a tight end, right?
As a tight end. There you go. I'm just checking you, Ron. Go ahead, Ron. Get him, baby. Can't pull one over on Ron. I'm just checking you. Great job, Ron. So I'm there as a tight end. I caught two or three passes.
Nobody your size is a wide receiver. I'm sorry.
No. So what happened was we had beaten USC last game. We go to Rose Bowl. And Coach Vermeil and Lynn Stiles, okay? Lynn Stiles coached for the San Francisco 49ers for a long time. He got a couple Super Bowl rings. Great man. So Coach Stiles and Coach Vermeil brought me into the office, and I remember Coach Vermeil saying, Jerry, you know, don't take this the wrong way. I love you. And he loves me to this day, and I still love Coach Vermeil. He said, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. As a wide receiver, you're like a dime a dozen. Don't take this the wrong way. He said, but if you move the inside linebacker from tight end, he said, you could revolutionize the position. They've never seen anybody that could do it. And I'm looking at him, I'm saying, and he said, by the way, we have 2 weeks to prepare for the Rose Bowl against the number one team in the country, Ohio State. I think you could actually play in it. I said, okay. So, Ron, I go back to my dormitory. I'm excited. I mean, I said, oh, my God, I only caught three passes all year long. And I actually was told that I ran the wrong pattern. I said, no, I must have ran the right pattern because I caught the ball. But anyway, they didn't want to hear that. So I'm coming back to the dormitory excited. One of my best friends said, are you crazy? Jerry, you are a tight end wide receiver. They will kill you. You're going to get hurt, da-da-da-da-da. And it upset me so bad, I looked at him. I said, you know what? I'm going to prove you wrong. So someone, they didn't see what was inside my heart. They just saw what was outside. And it kind of motivated me to prove everybody wrong. So from there on, you know, move from tight end to linebacker, and the rest is history, so to speak.
Tell me about the first time, the very first time you met Dick Vermeil.
I was a young high school kid at Cardinal Newman High School with a nice size afro, platform shoes. And I remember it was during that recruiting season, and when Coach Vermeil and Carl Peterson, they came to our house, I remember Coach Vermeil sitting down, and he said something totally different than all the other coaches. He looked at my mom and my dad and said, Mr. and Mrs. Robinson, I'm going to be real honest with you. I cannot guarantee you that your son, Jerry, is going to be a starter on this football team. But we will guarantee you one thing. He will get an education, and he will get an opportunity. That was the most honest thing any of the coaches had ever said. So my mom, see, Coach Vermeil, when I look back on it, and Carl Peterson, they were pretty smooth. You went over the moms.
Well, Tom Osborne at Nebraska, I had a player that he recruited. He said, I had a home in Jersey that was not the nicest of homes. He said he came into my home, and he said he sat with my mom for 4 hours. He said, you recruit the mom, you get the player.
That's how it went down. So that was that first experience with that. And, you know, I was really excited. And, you know, unfortunately, while I was my senior in high school, my brother, whose name was Jackie Robinson, he got shot in the head, and eventually he died. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because people are like, well, how come you went to UCLA? You didn't go to Notre Dame or somewhere out the state? It was during the time when, like I said, it was in December, my senior year, and I was going to go to Notre Dame. That's where I wanted to go to school, like everybody, a lot of people that I know. What happened was when that happened, I decided to stay close because L.A. and Santa Rosa, not that far apart. But Santa Rosa and South Bend, that's a long ways apart. So I wound up going to UCLA. And the reason I'm bringing this up is you never know what motivates people. You never know. You never know what drives people. And, you know, not everybody knows this story. Now we do. Not more people do. Thanks to you, Ron. I appreciate this. Sports byline. It's like my brother fought for his life for 13 months in a coma. He just didn't give up, and he got to a point where it was just time to go. And every time from that point on, every time it got difficult for me, when things didn't turn out the way I wanted to turn out, if I ever felt like quitting, I never did. Never did. So I tell kids all the time, never give up on your dreams. And whatever it is going to take you to motivate you to do whatever you have to do, so be it. And my brother Jackie, who I named my oldest daughter after, Jackie Robinson, and so that was one of the things that motivated me. That kept me rolling from my last year in high school to all the years at UCLA and my first year, especially with the Philadelphia Eagles, when I got hurt the very first year. I had pulled a hamstring. And as a rookie, that could be one of the roughest times in your life in the National Football League or any sport, because you will go through some mess. Baseball, football, doesn't matter which sport it is. And they were just giving me a hard time, and I just had it. I was just fed up. And I remember laying down on the practice field, Widener College, my first year with the Eagles, and I was just tired of these guys making me carry their clothes, change the oil in their car, making me put my hand over my heart, stand on a table, sing the UCLA fight song, everything. They were on my butt really bad. And I was just getting depressed because things weren't working out. I remember seeing an airplane, seriously, Ron, fly over. It was leaving Philadelphia International Airport. And it looked like it was headed back to California. And I looked at that plane, and I said, you know what? I could be on the next plane out of here. I'll give back the money. I'll give it all back. I just want out of here. Then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I start thinking about how my brother fought for his life, and he never gave up for his life. So I bring that up because I just want people to know that, you know, when you do it for somebody else, it's amazing how far you will go.
What kept it from being a negative experience in your life and your outlook and your attitude?
Yeah, well, my brother Jackie. My brother Jackie was born in January 1956. I was born in December 1956. We're both born in the same year. The first number in my professional career was number 56 because of it was in honor of my brother and all this kind of stuff. I remember the day that I got that call that I was at a basketball game waiting the next day to find out who we were going to play in the championship. And I get a call and the athletic director tells me to come in there because Jerry, your brother's been shot in the foot and you need to get to the hospital. So I go to the hospital. I get to the hospital, Ron. He's not shot in the foot. I'm like, Mom, where's Jackie? He's in the emergency room. Well, he was in the left corner of the emergency room just having convulsions. His body was jumping everywhere. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not a doctor, but I didn't know if that's what happened with a shot to your foot. I came outside, my mom and dad. I said, Mom, what are you talking about? Jackie got shot in the foot. She said, no, he got shot in the head. So what happened, my brother got shot in the head and about 2 minutes later, they wheel him out of this room and they're taking him somewhere else. And I'll never forget looking at my brother's head with that hole, the entry wound here and the exit wound came out under his head. And the exit wound came out underneath his throat. And the next day we had a championship basketball game. We had a championship basketball. I'd been up all night long looking for the people that shot my brother, looking for this and that. I'm just ready to go crazy. Got absolutely no sleep at all. It's about 3 hours before the basketball game the next day. I said, I don't want to play this. I don't feel like it. My mom and dad said, your brother Jackie would want you to play. And I went out there and, you know, wound up with the MVP award and the trophies and all this kind of stuff. But I just remember he just has always been this driving force behind me when things get tough.
At what point did Dick Vermeil come over to the Eagles? Were you already there or did he come after you and...
No, this is cool, too. I have all kinds of stories. The book will be out in about 6 months, you guys. We will launch it right here. Ron and Jerry will launch it right here, baby. Sports by line. I was at UCLA. We won the Rose Bowl. We beat Ohio State, the number one team. Dick Vermeil, in the newspaper, says, Coach Vermeil headed to Philadelphia Eagles. So we're as a team, we said, Coach Vermeil, what is this about? And he said, He said, I'm not going anywhere. I love it here. Next thing I know, the next day, headlines. They made him an offer he couldn't refuse. So my sophomore year, Coach Vermeil leaves. And then I was very fortunate to be able to be drafted first round by Coach Vermeil. And it's a long ways from Santa Rosa. Santa Rosa, Philadelphia, you look on the map, there's a lot of distance in between. And I remember the day I got drafted. I was excited and I was sad, too, because I didn't want to be that far away from my mom. And I remember calling my mom on the phone. She said, Pumpkin. She always called me Pumpkin. Pumpkin, why are you crying? And I just kind of told her about it. I said, Mom, it's so far away. She said, look at it like this. She said, you're going to Philadelphia with Dick Vermeil and his wife. She said, Jerry, they've always treated you like family. So you got an extended family out there. So it made a real big difference.
Were you happy about going to Philadelphia because Dick was there? And well, how much did you know about the city and their fans?
I found out they're very passionate fans. That people think the black hole is crazy. Go up in Philadelphia. The story about they chase Santa Claus out of there is true.
Well, the better one is they go out to the airport and boo bad landings.
Well, here, how about this? There actually was a jail.
In the stadium.
And it was always busy. The judge had the 50-yard line seat, so he could see who was getting ready to take down there. But you know what? I knew Philadelphia was like, I'm a native Californian. I'm a warm weather brother. I don't surf, nor do I swim, but I like warm weather, okay? I knew it snows in chilly Philly. I knew that. And it was so far away. But once I got there, the fans were just so passionate. I loved it there. I really did.
Well, the one thing I've always said about California, I call my friends back east in the middle of the winter, and I say, the only white thing we see on the ground in winter is sand, and we think 32 is an athlete's number, not the temperature.
This is true.
What was the hardest thing about acclimating yourself to NFL football?
The guys were a lot, it goes like this. You go from high school. as an All-American, you get to college, there's a whole bunch of All-Americans. You go to the pros, there's a larger group of college All-Americans there. The guys are bigger, guys are stronger, and they're faster. And now, instead of being in school where you have so many compliances you have to deal with all the time, where they can't keep you all the time, you go to the pros, you're there from sun up to sundown if that's the way they want it. So it required a lot more time and effort, and which was fine with me. But like I said, I think it was the amazement of between one 300-pounder to like four or five 300-pounder offensive linemen just running all over the place.
What were the Eagles like when you got there? I mean, as far as success.
They had just had the medal, Miracle in the Meadowlands, when Herman Edwards, when Joe Prisarjic, two ticks on the clock. The Eagles are one game away from getting into the playoffs. Joe Prisarjic, New York Giants, all he had to do was take the ball and kneel down. Well, Joe decided not, as he was trying to kneel down, the ball bounced up. Herman Edwards picked the ball up, scooped it up, and the Philadelphia Eagles went to their first playoff game in a long time.
John McVay was the coach of the Giants, and it was his last game, too.
Yeah, so the Philadelphia Eagles had just squeaked into the playoff situation, and it was a rebuilding year. It was one of those things where, if you follow Coach Vermeil's his history, it seemed like when he took over a team, whether it was at UCLA, it took 3 or 4 years. We go to the Rose Bowl, we win. He takes the Philadelphia Eagles, gave him 3 or 4 years. They win a playoff game. 2 years later, a year later, I'm there. A year after that, we're in the Super Bowl. He retires from the Philadelphia Eagles. Whoa. Then he unretires and goes to the Rams. Well, 3 years or 4 years after he was there, guess what? They're hoisting the Lombardi Trophy. So it was a rebuilding year when in the second or third year of the rebuilding year with the Philadelphia Eagles. But you know what? I tell you what, we worked harder than anybody. Coach Vermeil believed in hard work. If you don't have, even if you do have a lot of talent, but say, for instance, if you really don't have a whole lot of talent, you're going to have to work harder. You're going to have to be smarter. You're going to have to be in better shape. What I loved about Coach Vermeil was, although we had those 3-hour and 30-minute practices, Coach Vermeil worked himself and his entire staff just as hard as we worked. I mean, they spent 3 nights at the stadium studying film and getting ready for film preparation.
That was the first time that a wild card team had gone to the Super Bowl. And, of course, it was the Raiders that won that Super Bowl. And you talk about the hard work, and I was covering the Raiders at that time, and I went back to Cleveland. And, of course, that was when Sam Ratigliano and the Cleveland Browns, they had their game won, too, except for an interception in the end zone that sealed the game for the Raiders. And I say all of this as a lead up to the fact that you know as well as I do that everybody said the reason you guys lost that Super Bowl against the Raiders is that Dick Vermeil worked you guys to death, that you left your best game on the practice field.
I really believe that the best game that we played that year was when we beat the Dallas Cowboys to go to the Super Bowl. Nothing was going to change just because we made it to the Super Bowl with Coach Vermeil. It's like you dance with the partner that got you here, and you continue to do the same dances. Yes, we did work extremely hard.
You were out by the airport, were you not?
Yeah, we were out by the airport.
You guys, I never saw you on Bourbon Street.
No. You didn't see us, but I tell you what I did one night. You know, you're down there for a week, and then the families come in. Okay, so my wife, my dad, my mom, everybody, they come down, and here it is. They're in town, and we had curfew, 11 o'clock. I'm in the room, 11:30. I'm like, this is ridiculous. My family's here. They're talking about Bourbon Street. I'm on the edge of the bed, 11:45, live TV, Bourbon Street. John Matuszak drinking Hurricanes, having a ball. The Raiders were having so much freaking fun. I'm sitting on the edge of the bed. I'm highly upset. I'm looking real close to the TV, and I see my wife, my dad, my mom, everybody down there with the Raiders. I'm like, something's wrong with this picture. So while the Raiders were down there just letting their hair down, relaxing, because they've been there before to a Super Bowl, and ours, we hadn't been. I think it made a big difference. We did work extremely hard. We weren't very relaxed, but we were a better team. Our record was better, and the Raiders was the first wild card team. They were just ready to prepare. They were prepared, and they had been there before, and you could see the difference when the Philadelphia Eagles were introduced and the Raiders were introduced. The Raiders were just laid back, you know.
Well, my favorite story is that Sam Rantigliano, you know, had lost that ball game. They make it to the Super Bowl, and the guys are really excited about that. And Tom Flores is the coach, and Tom put in a curfew, too. On Thursday night, it was that you had to be in by midnight. Well, the guys showed up at midnight, but then at about 12:01, they're out the door, and I hook up with John Matuszak, and so we go down to Bourbon Street. And so you were right about the Hurricanes, you know, and it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're coming back into the team hotel, and coming down the steps of the hotel is Tom Flores, and in come Matuszak and I. And, you know, I mean, we'd had a good time, and Tom looks at John and says, "Where have you been?" And I turned to John and I said, Tom, John could not sleep, and we went out looking for a warm glass of milk.
You were cruising with the twos.
I was cruising with the twos. And so Tom looks down and he says, "Well, John, that warm glass of milk is going to cost you $5,000.
Yeah, you know, those Raiders, they were very relaxed. As a matter of fact, once I became, you know, I got traded to the Raiders in 85, and Matt Millen was telling me, he said, when they started practice that week, he said, everything was, they were too uptight. They were really uptight, and everybody was quiet. And he said, he looked at Rod Martin and said, "Rod, I'm getting ready to start a fight." All of a sudden, fight breaks out, offense against defense. And after that, it was done. After that, they were all relaxed, and they went on to continue, and they beat the Philadelphia Eagles in Super Bowl 50. What was the score?
I don't remember. But
good, I don't either.
Because Rod Martin was the MVP of that Super Bowl.
He should have been.
Had what, three interceptions in that game. And again, I go back to what we were talking about earlier. As I watched that game, you guys in the third quarter were just, you'd been run out. I mean, mm-hmm. you just did not react to the plays and everything. And that's why I asked the question. Was it a fair criticism that you guys left it on the practice
field? That was very fair, because we did work hard. We worked extremely hard. And I will let you know this, too. Playing on AstroTurf would just take it out of you. It'll take you out of you. And we're playing the Raiders, and they were just running all over the place. They were doing what they wanted to do. And we lost a little bit of composure here and there, and they just started having a field day. But we did work extremely hard. I'm not going to say that was the only reason, but that might have had something to do with it. All I know is it's great to get to a Super Bowl.
Okay, you switch gears. You go from the good guys to the bandits,
yeah,
with the Raiders.
The Raiders.
What was that like? I mean, you'd seen that organization from the outside. You certainly, having grown up in the Bay Area, knew what the reputation was. You, Matuszak, and all the other bad dudes that were there. What was it like? What did you assume it was going to be like, and what was it like when you got there?
Well, I grew up in Santa Rosa, where the Raiders' first training camp
was,
so I already knew what it was going to be like. And when I got traded, when I was going through my trading process, they asked me, they said, "Okay, Jerry, if you had your choice, where would you want to go?" I said, "The Raiders." "Well, give me another choice." I said, "The Raiders. I've always wanted to play for the Raiders," because they were, you know, Santa Rosa, I'm a kid, watched, you know, Daryl LaMonica, Otis Sistrunk, and Kenny Stabler, and all George Atkinson, all these guys when I was a young kid. So when I came to the Raiders, when I got traded to the Raiders, I was excited. I didn't want to really leave Philadelphia, but my hand was kind of forced, because there were some great fans of Philadelphia. I loved it. Matter of fact, it was a very emotional day for me when I had to leave Philadelphia. I didn't leave because I wanted to. It was because things just didn't work out with the new owner. But the day I came to the Raiders, I remember it was on a day off in L.A. Went to El Segundo. Went to the facility. Got my physicals out the way. So I come back to the facility. I'm waiting for the shuttle bus to take me back to the hotel. And I'm sitting there, and I sit down on my stool, little silver stool, and then I just turned around, and I saw that helmet, and I just stood up, grabbed the helmet, and put the helmet on, and I had my street clothes on, and I sat back down, and I said, "Oh, God, I finally made it."
Jerry Robinson still laughs and smiles when he talks about football. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr. And thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.